Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. A man I've come to know and admire greatly over many years, both as a colleague in Senator Jackson's staff and as a colleague in the Pentagon and as a colleague in various other post-government capacities, is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Douglas J. Feith. He has served with great distinction in that capacity, also as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Negotiations Policy, and on the National Security Council staff under President Reagan. Doug is today the Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute. And in that capacity and many others, he is contributing mightily in an ongoing basis to the national security debate and informing it with some of the greatest, I think, thinking and analysis available. Much of that can be found, by the way, in his terrific book, really the definitive book on the Gulf War under President George W. Bush, entitled War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Doug Feith, thank you for taking a full hour with us to talk about the world we're in at the moment and the challenges that the United States must both understand and rise to. And thanks for all you're doing to help us figure that out and do so. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you, as always.
I guess I'd like to start with a sort of calibration on the nature of the enemy that we are facing at the moment, most immediately at least. We'll get to some of the others that are looming on the horizon. But there is some concern, Doug, as you know, that we're not really clear about what the problem is at the moment. And when the president, for example, tells us that the Islamic State is not Islamic, kind of captures the question, do we in fact understand that there's a global jihad underway, not just something that is a product of this franchise of that group or movement or another?
Well, one of the serious strategic and intellectual challenges that have confronted the United States since 9/11 has been understanding the nature of the enemy that attacked us on 9/11 and that has been threatening us and trying to attack us and in some cases successfully attacking us since. And I think that there was a particularly acute challenge in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 when I saw the Bush administration grappling with, you know, how do you name the enemy? The president immediately, within hours of the 9/11 attack, basically as a placeholder, said this is a war on terrorism. And, of course, he understood that was a way of avoiding naming a specific enemy because it was just very difficult to conceptualize what it is we were up against. And it was a perfectly okay term as a placeholder, but there was a question of, is the enemy an organization? Is the enemy a set of organizations? Is the enemy those organizations and their state sponsors? You know, how do you think about it? We finally came up with the idea that the enemy was a network of terrorist organizations and their state sponsors who were tied together by an ideology. And over time, there came to be increasing understanding that the essential trait that tied together the different groups that we were fighting in the war on terrorism was an Islamist extremist ideology. And as I said, there was kind of a growing appreciation of that. When President Obama came in, he made an attack, as it were, on that concept of the enemy. And he went out of his way to deny that it was proper to think of the enemy as an Islamist ideology. And he started his administration with himself and people like John Brennan, who's now the CIA director, specifically saying Islam has nothing to do with it, jihad has nothing to do with it, de-emphasizing the ideological nature of the enemy and emphasizing instead Al-Qaeda as an organization.
In fact, just a subset of Al-Qaeda as an organization, it seems, for most purposes, at least, so-called Al-Qaeda core.
Right. Initially, he said Al-Qaeda. And so they redefined the enemy in a much narrower way than we had in the Bush administration by simply focusing organizationally on Al-Qaeda rather than the broader network of these extremist, you know, Islamist extremist groups and their state sponsors, which is the way we did it in the Bush administration. What's happened is that initial effort by the Obama administration to narrow the definition of the enemy has been essentially, you know, discredited or embarrassed by events. And now we find that the administration is increasingly coming to understand that it's not Al-Qaeda as such, it's Al-Qaeda and spin-off and affiliated and related organizations or groups or individuals who are part of a movement. And what ties that movement together is precisely the Islamist ideology that the administration, that the Obama administration had initially tried to deny was the problem. And the perfect symbol of how the Obama administration has been changing, because their original analysis was wrong, is John Brennan started off giving speeches in 2009, and he gave more than one, in which he specifically said it would be a terrible mistake to refer to these people as either Islamists or jihadists. And recently, President Obama himself has referred to them as jihadists. So there's a growing understanding of the nature of the problem, but I think this administration is still grappling with, you know, with these definitional questions.
Doug Feith is our guest. He served as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the number three position in the George W. Bush Pentagon from 2001 to 2005. And Doug, let me just press you on this, because I know critics of the Bush administration hearing this would almost certainly point out that George W. Bush himself used phrases very like those that you've properly, I think, criticized President Obama and John Brennan for, to the effect that Islam is a religion of peace and the people who were hijacking the planes on 9/11, you know, were trying to hijack this great Abrahamic faith, and jihad is about personal struggle and all this. And in fact, it seemed perhaps in the internal deliberations of the administration over time that this Islamist ideology, as you put it, became more and more clearly recognized as the problem. But publicly, and I think in terms of the awareness, the situational awareness, if I may use that military term, of what we're up against among the public, at very least, is affected still by kind of those early days and characterization of the threat, which, as you certainly rightly say, carried forward under President Obama, perhaps to this very day.
Yes, but I think there is an important and it's intellectually and strategically important distinction to draw that President Bush drew, and that I think to some extent President Obama is overdrawing, and that is the distinction between Islam as a religion and Islamism as a totalitarian political ideology.
Doug, I want to hold that thought because we have to break for just a moment, but that's a great spot on which to return because it does seem to me that there is a distinction to be made. I think they use the term Sharia rather than Islamism, but whatever you use to define this political totalitarian system, it is clearly what is animating this whole cast of jihadist characters from the Muslim Brotherhood right on through to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. That will be the topic we'll drill down a bit further on with Douglas J. Feith right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Can America ever end its dependence on foreign oil?
You gotta choose. Do you want to go to the movies with your kids or do you want to buy gas?
It hurts.
From Submarine Deluxe, one film shows you how.
You have the ability to stop using oil right now.
Pump is the movie critics are calling powerful and eye-opening. A must-see for every American.
I spend about $100 a day in gas. Now I'm spending about $20.
Pump.
It's right here in America. It's American.
Rated PG. Now playing exclusively at the AMC Hoffman Center 22 in West End Cinemas.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're having a very important and, pleased to say, hour-long conversation with one of the most thoughtful national security practitioners I've had the privilege of knowing and working with over the years, Douglas J. Feith, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, author of War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Doug is today a senior fellow and director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the highly regarded Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. Doug, we were talking a little bit about this issue of the distinction to be drawn between many, many Muslims around the world, certainly in this country and arguably hundreds of millions elsewhere, who do not subscribe to this doctrine they call Sharia, and those, by distinction, who very much do and who seek to impose it on the rest of us. Talk a little bit about the differences you see between the approaches to the Obama administration has been taking and that of the Bush administration on that line.
I think that the distinction that is important to make is between Islam as a religion and Islamism as a political ideology. And it's a totalitarian political ideology. And it's important that I think we as a country learn about the distinction and become comfortable with the distinction, because one of the problems that I think we've had in as a whole, as a country and as a government in dealing with this threat is Americans properly and admirably are reluctant to do anything that looks like, prejudice or hostility to a religion. And that's one of the things that makes America great. And nobody is comfortable with attacking Islam as such. It happens to be, though, that our enemies in this, what's been called the war on terrorism for many years, our enemies are tied together by an ideology. And the ideology, which can be called Islamism, is promoted by people who say they are acting in the name of Islam.
We're speaking with Douglas J. Feith, a colleague and friend of many years, now with the Hudson Institute. And Doug, you were talking a little bit about the degree to which those who are following this doctrine or ideology that you call Islamism, I think they call the adherence to it, they call Sharia. And how is it you can tell which Muslims you're dealing with in a practical sense, for that matter, here as well as overseas?
Well, the proponents of this extreme political totalitarian ideology are people who claim to be speaking in the name of Islam, but there are many Muslims who don't subscribe to that view, and they have disagreements within their own community. And in fact, people who thought seriously and strategically about our problem with in the war on terrorism have understood that one of the keys to victory is getting the Muslims who don't subscribe to that ideology to be even more active and courageous and bold and effective in fighting those Muslims who claim to be operating in the name of the religion, who subscribe to this to the political ideology. But I think it's very important for Americans to understand the distinction and to understand that one can fight the political ideology of Islamism without in any way being bigoted against Islam. And this is quite important, because the nature of this fight is, in essence, ideological. And if we're uncomfortable fighting the ideology because we think that means that you're bigoted against the religion, then what we wind up as a government doing is not fighting the ideological aspects of the war. And this is a war that requires more than military action or more than intelligence action and even more than financial action. It requires an important ideological effort to discredit the Islamist ideology that is motivating these terrorists.
I couldn't agree more, and I want to come back to that, but just stay with this theme for a moment. We do have
people, and they have clearly been extraordinarily influential in and had great access to the Obama administration, with ties to an organization that has been promoting precisely the opposite meme, namely that you can't possibly say anything about Islam or Islamism or Sharia or any other facet of this program, ideological or otherwise, without giving offense to Muslims. And this would be the cadre of folks associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. The administration has seen fit, as you know, Doug Feith, to endorse the Muslim Brotherhood, to legitimate it, to help bring it to power in Egypt, to fund it, and even in the case of Egypt for a time, to arm it. And I just wonder what you make of that as a strategic decision, especially against the backdrop of how you perceived this problem during the Bush years.
Well, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think you highlighted a number of problems. There was a widely held view. The Muslim Brotherhood is an organization that was founded in Egypt in the late 1920s. And some of the most important ideological work done in Islamism in the modern period, in the last 100 years, was done by the Muslim Brotherhood. They have developed the thinking that is really at the core of our problem. And so the Muslim Brotherhood has been a very influential, dangerous, and I think really bad organization. One of the reasons that a lot of people, I think, misunderstand the Muslim Brotherhood and its nature is because when they were operating in Egypt, and the various Egyptian governments over the years cracked down on them very, very brutally, the Muslim Brotherhood decided as a matter of tactics that violence was not good for them. They didn't decide that violence and the kind of violence that we see with the terrorist attacks against ordinary people is philosophically wrong or wrong in principle. They just decided it was wrong for them in Egypt because it was getting them killed. And it was inexpedient. And so people in the West after 9/11, I think a number of people misunderstood what was going on, and they thought that the Muslim Brotherhood was in principle against terrorism. And they thought that a good strategy against the Al-Qaeda kind of extremists was to embrace the Muslim Brotherhood as an example of people who have Islamist views but are anti-violence, as if they were anti-violence in principle, which they're not.
Or Doug, I would even suggest that they actually thought maybe they weren't even Islamists. They were the representatives, the legitimate, authentic representatives of all those Muslims who don't want any of this awful stuff. But in fact, as you say, they were both Islamists and perfectly prepared. Witness their franchise in the Palestinian areas, Hamas, to engage in violence where they did think it was expedient.
Right. And I think it was a serious mistake on the part of a number of people in the U.S. government and governments around the world to think that the Muslim Brotherhood represented a moderate force that we could work with and even ally with in our fight against Al-Qaeda.
Bring to the fore and in other ways make dominant. Doug, we have to pause for one more second. We have a break coming up. We'll be right back with more with Douglas J. Feith, one of the preeminent thinkers on national security matters in Washington today, and specifically how you wage an effective counter-ideological war. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Here's a news flash. The New York Times reported Wednesday that American military personnel in Iraq last decade were harmed by some of Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons. What makes this newsworthy, of course, is that the New York Times and all the rest of the mainstream media had been saying for years that there were no chemical or other weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The meme they relentlessly promoted was that Bush lied and people died. It turns out that if the George W. Bush administration lied, it was by declining to refute this slander. Instead, it concealed the fact that American troops were harmed by some of the thousands of chemical arms discovered by U.S. forces but left in place. That error destroyed the Bush presidency and needlessly devastated American lives. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change your minds.
They're not going to change your minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Douglas J. Fife is our guest for this full hour, a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio. We're talking about the nature of the war we're in, the character of the enemy we're up against, the mistakes that have been made in both understanding that enemy and bringing appropriate strategies to bear against what is fundamentally an ideological and indeed global threat. And Doug Fife, we were talking a bit about this business of Islamism, as you call it. And I just wonder, at the moment, the president is making much of the fact that we have on our team encountering these Islamists, a variety of nations that are actually prime movers behind, funders of, enablers of, and for that matter, adherents to this Sharia or Islamist doctrine, notably Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey under Erdogan. Are we mischaracterizing our friends in this regard, perhaps as much as our enemies?
I think to some extent we are, and these topics have become extremely complex because, as is true with international affairs in general, you often have, in major international problems, elements that relate to ideology mixing with elements that relate to non-ideological interests, just like, you know, basic security interests or economic interests or political interests. And, you know, sometimes you get, you know, funny alignments and realignments because of this. You mentioned Qatar and Saudi Arabia, for example. Now, Qatar and Saudi Arabia have a number of things in common. They're the only two countries in the world that have Wahhabi governments. I mean, their government subscribed to this particular strain of Muslim thinking, Salafi thinking, known as Wahhab, you know, named after this guy named Al-Wahhab, who was an 18th century preacher. And so they, you know, they share this religious view.
Is there a distinction between Wahhabism, as you understand it, and Islamism, as you've described it?
There are some differences, but there are also there's a lot of overlap. And I mean, they're not precisely the same thing, but they're in some ways mutually reinforcing. But here's the thing. The interesting thing is that Qatar and Saudi Arabia, perhaps because they share some of these views, are quite bitter enemies. And to a large extent, if you want to understand Qatari foreign policy, understand that they do whatever they can to stick a thumb in the Saudis' eye. And they, you know, Qatar set up the Al Jazeera television to a large extent to provoke the Saudis. And it doesn't mean that either one of them is necessarily good or friendly to the United States on important issues, but they are at each other's throats all the time.
Notably on the Muslim Brotherhood at the moment.
On the Muslim Brotherhood. Qatar is strongly supporting, for example, Hamas in Gaza, whereas this...
They just committed to give them $1 billion after this recent war with Israel.
Right. But at the same time, the Saudis were obviously not at all on Hamas's side in the recent war, which is extraordinary because the Saudis have a very long history of bitter hostility toward Israel. But in the recent war, time after time, by acts of omission and commission, they made it clear that their sympathies were not at all with Hamas. I wouldn't say that their sympathies were with Israel, but they were specifically the Saudis were anti-Hamas. And so they were fighting with Qatar on this question. And so anyway, these are very complex pictures, and some of it relate to personal rivalries. And
I take the point, Doug, but at the end of the day, what I think it's fair to say is that we're likely to see in the future, as we have in the past, kind of a double game at best out of these guys in terms of support for us, bases, you know, buying military hardware, opposing, at least nominally, people like the Islamic State if they see it as a threat, but also enabling some of this very Islamist or Sharia, you know, jihadist enterprise as well. Let me turn quickly, because you have spent a lot of time both in government as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and out of government in the private sector, focused on Turkey. What do we to make of this NATO ally and its role, notably of late with the Kurds, but more broadly in terms of their support for many of these jihadist elements, at the very least Al-Qaeda's al-Nusra Front, if not actually one of its previous subsets, this Islamic State?
Turkey has been a very disturbing player in world affairs over the last 10 years since the Erdogan government came in. Turkey was, for a very long time, a close, reliable, and important ally of the United States and within NATO. When Erdogan came in as prime minister in late 2002, he obviously brought with him, and it was reasonably clear at the time, it's even more clear in retrospect, he brought with him an extraordinary ambition to change Turkey's position in the world. He was really a very strategic, creative thinker for Turkey, taking it, I think, in a disastrously wrong direction. But given his lights, He's been amazingly successful in doing what he wanted to do. He wanted to reorient, and quite literally reorient Turkey in the sense of point it toward the east again. When the Turkish Republic was founded, the idea was that Ataturk, the founder of the Turkish Republic, had was to convert what had been an Oriental Muslim empire into a Western liberal democratic European state. Erdogan came in and basically said, I want to undo that and point Turkey again toward the east, toward its Muslim connections, away from the West, and make it more like the old Ottoman Empire as a dominant figure in its region, emphasizing much more its Muslim character than its European character.
If not actually recreating the old caliphate, ultimately, as a Muslim kind of enterprise with far wider ambitions, obviously.
That's right. People now talk about, you know, people who want to create a Muslim caliphate as if it's something that's, you know, just wild in one's imagination. But, of course, there was a caliphate until the years immediately after World War One. There was a caliphate for hundreds of years, and it was based in Istanbul, and the Turkish Sultan was the caliph, and it was Ataturk who put it to rest. I mean, he overthrew the Sultan and the Sultan caliph and created the Republic of Turkey in place of what had been the Sultanate and the Caliphate. And there are people and Erdogan obviously does have some, you know, seems to have some sympathy with the idea that it wouldn't be a bad thing to recreate it.
Some aspirations, one might actually say, to, if not play that role himself, certainly facilitate and manage the enterprise. Doug Feith, we have to pause for one last break. We're going to be back with Doug and talk more about, in contrast to the kind of strategy that the president has laid out vis-a-vis this Islamic State, one subset of the larger global jihad, what kind of strategy might be actually a winning one for the United States and its like-minded friends and allies around the world, and how to bring it about under present circumstances? That and more with Douglas J. Feith, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute, and former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Can America ever end its dependence on foreign oil?
You gotta choose. Do you want to go to the movies with your kids or do you want to buy gas?
It hurts.
From Submarine Deluxe, one film shows you how.
You have the ability to stop using oil right now.
Pump is the movie critics are calling powerful and eye-opening. A must-see for every American.
I spend about $100 a day in gas. Now I'm spending about $20.
Pump.
It's right here in America. It's American.
Rated PG. Now playing exclusively at the AMC Hoffman Center 22 in West End Cinemas.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, I'm very sorry to say, for what is already the final segment of this special hour-long conversation with a friend and colleague of many years, Douglas J. Feith. He is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under George W. Bush, and today with the Hudson Institute's National Security Strategies Program, which he directs. Doug, we've had so many important aspects of this problem addressed so far, but the thing I want to double back to is something that is a perhaps special significance, and that is how do we both organize and execute a strategy that would be appropriate to the kind of counter-ideological struggle? It has its kinetic dimensions, of course. It has a host of other elements, including, energy issues, economic issues, more generally, the sort of political warfare, intelligence activities, and so on, that
I'm fond of hearkening back to a strategy that you and I back in the day had a small hand in executing for President Reagan, codified most notably in National Security Decision Directive 75, which really was the essence of his counter-ideological strategy for taking down the Soviet Union. And give us your thoughts on how relevant that is to today's challenge and how, if it is, we can adopt and execute it.
The U.S. government as an institution is not comfortable with, is not organized to do serious counter-ideological work. And that's been true for quite a few decades. I think it's basically since the 1950s, when we had a fairly serious ideological effort against communism, and especially in the early Cold War years in Europe and places like Greece and Italy. Since that time, the United States has not done a lot of serious work in countering hostile ideologies. And after 9/11, the Bush administration developed a general strategy for the war on terrorism that had three main elements. One was hardening the homeland, you know, protecting the homeland. The second was disrupting and attacking terrorist networks abroad. And the third was countering ideological support for terrorists. The first two elements of that strategy got a lot of action, and a lot of things were done, and the rather miraculous result was that we didn't have a repeat of a 9/11 scale attack. And I think that was, to a large extent, attributable to this very successful strategy. But the third element of the strategy, countering ideological support for terrorism, was always weak, even in the Bush administration. I think it was even weaker in the Obama administration, because the Obama administration came in, as we talked earlier, with its own ideas that were, I mean, in the Bush administration at least, there were many high-level officials who understood that it was important to do a job of countering the ideological support for the Islamist threat, although the government wasn't organized to do it and we didn't do it very well. The Obama people came in actually hostile to the idea of thinking of the challenge in those terms. They didn't want to think of it as an ideological problem, and they were much more interested in emphasizing how friendly we are toward Islam, which is a perfectly okay thing to say, but it's not the heart of the matter.
Unless you actually wind up, as a result of that, as we've been discussing, embracing Islamists in the process, notably the Muslim Brotherhood, but not exclusively.
Yeah, well, that's where it can become not only not helpful, but harmful. And that has been a problem. And I think that one of the things we see with the fight against ISIS or ISIL or Islamic State, as it's variously called, one of the things we see is that President Obama is getting some very rough education. Many of the things he said at the beginning of his presidency on this general subject of Islamism and terrorism and his critique of the Bush administration is wrong. And he's having to rethink it, and he's having to scramble and change the way he approaches things and change his terminology. And a lot of the confusion I think you see in the Obama administration's policies is a reflection of the fact that things they said at the beginning were just wrong.
It's kind of mugged by reality. I'm not sure I'm seeing as much evidence, Doug Feith, as you seem to be, of actual change. There's unquestionably a strategic incoherence at the moment.
I think it's highly significant that the president has, on a number of occasions, used the term jihadist to describe the enemy. And that really is a kind of intellectual revolution.
If, in fact, it now is something that becomes a basis for policy. And it is striking that, you know, on her way out the door, not as far as I could tell any time during her service in the State Department, but on her way out the door, Hillary Clinton did warn that we were involved in a global jihad on a couple of occasions in congressional testimony. And maybe that's now becoming increasingly clear to the administration that continues to be in office. But it hasn't been evident in the strategy to date. So, Doug Feith, just very quickly, is something like President Reagan's National Security Decision Directive 75 counter-ideological but comprehensive national effort to defeat this current totalitarian foe in order at the moment? And if so, how do we get there from here?
I think it is. This is something that one way to think about it is this. It makes a lot of sense for the U.S. government to invest a lot in an effort to try to prevent people from becoming murderous enemies of the United States to begin with, rather than ignore the ideological aspects that are so crucial to recruitment and indoctrination of these Islamic terrorists, and then go trying to find and capture or kill them. The capture and kill operations are difficult, highly costly in financial terms and in political terms. We would be a lot better off spending much more attention trying to prevent people from becoming enemies to begin with by addressing some of these ideological problems.
The pipeline that you are familiar with, Doug, that your old boss Don Rumsfeld warned was going to be producing these guys faster than we could kill them.
Exactly. Well, he came up with that because we talked about this a lot, and he fully understood the value of prevention rather than, you know, trying to hunt them down after the fact.
You know, I consider it one of the great tragedies that the office that was set up for a brief period under, I think, your auspices, the Office of Strategic Influence, wasn't able to go to work on this problem because it might have had a very different outcome.
I think that's right, and I think that it highlights the point that is important for people to understand, which is there is no office in the entire United States government whose responsibility it is to fight the ideological part of the war on terrorism. Nobody actually has this responsibility. We have a public diplomacy office at state, but public diplomacy is not the same thing as a serious ideological effort to counter support for Islamism. And one of the things that would be useful would be for the president to, you know, if we had a president who was so inclined and understood the importance of this, to create some kind of mechanism within the U.S. government, and he would have to create it because it doesn't exist, to take on this mission and deal with it as a strategic campaign.
This is an incredibly important point, and it's the last one we'll be able to make in the course of this conversation with you, Doug Feith. I very much hope that such an effort might come about. You've written about this issue of how to organize the U.S. government for counter-ideological war with your colleague at the Hudson Institute, Abe Schulsky, and Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution. We hope that that kind of clear blueprint might be adopted, as well as clarity about the nature of the ideological foe we face. I thank you, Doug, for your collective service, both in public office and in the private sector, and for sharing your insights with us today. Again, Douglas J. Feith, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute and former Undersecretary of Defense. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.